Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
What are the landmark legal cases regarding teaching the controversy over evolution? I'm Keith Pinnock, and today on our show, we have a radio interview that Policy and Legal Affairs Officer Casey Luskin did with ARN's Kevin Wirth, where they discuss just that.
On today's show, I'm going to provide you with a new resource that I have been looking forward to for a long, long time, and I know that it'll be of tremendous benefit to many of you. As we engage in the discussion about education and the legalities of what's permissible and what isn't, we all know that there exists a growing list of legal cases related to Darwinism, evolution, creationism, intelligent design, and so on. But it has been a long-standing hope of mine to someday see a comprehensive list of those cases presented in a summary format that regular folks like you and I, as well as legal beagles, could use as a reference tool to give us at least a starting point for identifying and explaining the key legal cases and landmines that we should all be aware of. We have as our special guest today someone who has actually created such a list of cases, and we're going to not only talk about them, but make sure that we get this information into your hands so that you can use it. So you'll want to get a pencil and paper ready to take notes from today's show and write down some website addresses where you can get more information. Our guest today is Mr. Casey Luskin, an attorney currently working for the Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington. Casey is a California licensed attorney with a BS and MS in Earth Sciences from the University of California at San Diego, where he took many courses in evolutionary biology. He earned his law degree from the University of San Diego, and in 1999, he co-founded the first Intelligent Design and Evolution Awareness, or IDEA Club, at UCSD to promote ID to students. In 2001, he co-founded the IDEA Center as a nonprofit that has helped students form IDEA Clubs in over 30 university and high school campuses. Casey served as president and board chair of the IDEA Center until 2006, and now helps as president emeritus and a member of the IDEA's board of directors. In 2005, Casey joined Discovery Institute as program officer in public policy and legal affairs. One of his first assignments was observing about a third of the Kitzmiller trial, which led to him co-authoring a book called Traipsing into Evolution, which critiqued that ruling. Casey's primary role at Discovery is assisting educators to teach evolution objectively without incurring legal problems. He has also helped to defend academics who are being persecuted due to their pro-ID views and works closely with those backing academic freedom legislation. Around that time, I guess it was about April of 2005, Casey and I were both attending a conference together, and during one of my presentations, I mentioned to those in the room that I had begun work on a project outlining some of the key cases related to evolution and intelligent design, and I asked if anyone might like to work on that project with me, and Casey immediately responded that he'd be interested. Over the course of the next few months, and unknown to me, he greatly expanded on what I'd outlined and eventually produced something that has recently been published. And I think it's an excellent list of those cases that we all need to know about, and because he's published it, it's now accessible to the public as a downloadable PDF file. In fact, if you're ready to write this down, you can go take a look at it online at www.discovery.org/a/11291. The article was published in the winter edition of the 2009 Hamline Law Review, Volume 32, Number 1. So, Casey, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Kevin.
It's a great pleasure to have you with us, and I want to personally thank you for all your hard work. And I know that you do a phenomenal amount of work on this issue, and as significant as this effort is that you've produced, it's really only a fraction of what I know you've done. So, Casey, before we dig into the questions about the survey, I wanted to ask you more of a personal question, and I think our listeners would be interested in knowing this too. I'd like to know what it was that got you interested in this debate in the first place. In other words, what jerked your chain, so to speak, and why have you stuck with it since then? And why do you think this issue is so important?
Well, before I got interested in the legal side of this question, Kevin, I was very much interested in the science side of the question. And I would say to this day, it's the science of this issue that really gets me going. I mean, that's what really excites me. I grew up as a kid. I was always interested in science. I think that this is a fascinating topic because you can explore this foundational question of humanity that everyone wrestles with. You know, where did we come from? You can explore it from science. You can explore it from philosophy, from law, from religion. I mean, really, all of the major disciplines of humanity intersect in this one issue. And so for somebody who just finds all these different topics fascinating. It's a wonderful place to really just, I don't know, get your intellect on, I guess, and just think about these things. It's a lot of fun. Some people say, you know, you catch the bug of the origins debate. I have the bug, and I found that, you know, it's contagious, so stay away from me. But but I think that, you know, sometimes you just catch the bug, you get fascinated by this question, you realize that these questions run so deep, and there's so much there to talk about. I think that part of my question is, why wouldn't everybody be fascinated by this timeless question of where do we come from? You, whether you're religious or not, just this is a question that's fundamental to humanity. And so I find it absolutely fascinating. I think that for me, when I really got interested in this question and really started to investigate it for myself was actually in college. The first lecture, the first class I took in college was called History of the Earth and Evolution. I had signed up for some elective freshman fall quarter class that looked interesting. I didn't know much about, you know, this History of the Earth and Evolution course. And I took this class and had a textbook that was covering evolution and the fossil record. And immediately, I mean, I was just completely hooked. I started buying books, checking out books. It was at the end of my freshman year of college that I read Darwin's Black Box by Michael Behe. And that was my first introduction to intelligent design, and took a whole bunch of other courses. And it was just all downhill from there. So, I mean, it's just one of those things where you get interested in a question, you realize there's a lot there to think about. I never was able to turn back, basically.
So before we really start getting into your survey here, who are the people that you think are going to benefit the most from the survey, and why should they read it?
Well, I wrote this survey of case law really for two audiences. One is the general lay public, who understands that the origins debate also has a legal dimension, but it's kind of like a big black hole. They don't really understand it. This survey allows someone who's just a member of the public or the lay public to understand what the case history and the legal history of this issue has said, and hopefully in a way that is not too filled with legal jargon, where they can understand, you know, what have the courts ruled on this topic. So that's why I break up the 21 cases that are surveyed into some fairly easy to understand categories. The other group that I hope will benefit from this article is really an attorney or legal scholar who is seeking what I would call a matrix-style brain upload. You know, in the movie The Matrix, where they say, oh, I need to know how to fly a helicopter. So back in the ship, you know, they put a CD into the drive that into their brain that teaches them how to fly a helicopter, and suddenly they're an expert on helicopter flight. Well, I hope that after reading this article, you might experience something like that. If you're a legal scholar, you could read this short 60-page article, which for a lot of your articles isn't too ambitious, and you could really all of a sudden be an expert on the full breadth of the case law pertaining to the teaching of evolution and origin in public schools, and what's right with the cases, what's wrong with the cases, and what are some of the unsettled legal questions that courts have still yet to address.
Well, maybe we can create a CD and upload into other attorneys on how to swim in the ocean with other sharks. But anyway, that's great, Casey. I really like that. Just going to have us jump into your article and kind of hit the high spots here. In your intro, you mentioned that there's a striking finding. I'm just going to quote what you say here. There's a striking finding that although the courts have firmly upheld the rights of educators to teach evolution and have rejected attempts to teach creationism, none of these cases indicate that a school board is necessarily placed in constitutional jeopardy by a curriculum that teaches scientific critiques of evolution. I think that's kind of important. Why do you think that that's important?
Well, I think it's important because it's absolutely vital that students be exposed to the scientific evidence, both for and against evolution in public schools. You asked me in the previous session, you know, what really got me interested in this issue. I think that one thing that also got me very inspired as far as the legal side of this issue goes was my experience in high school and college, mostly college, where I realized that there is an entire side of the scientific evidence in this issue that is by and large not disclosed to students when they learn about the subject of origins. And I think that that's an absolute travesty that students are being forced to make decisions about these questions of origins without having all the information presented to them, basically with having all the evidence that challenges evolution censored for them in the classroom. And to me, that's real travesty. I think that whatever conclusion, whatever decision you make, you should be able to make a fully informed decision, not having one side of the story basically censored and blocked from your mind. I think it's important for school boards and school districts that want to allow students to make informed decisions on these very important scientific questions and teach them how to think like scientists, teach them how to understand the facts of biology as best as they can, that they have the right to disclose to students both the scientific evidence that supports evolution, I think that should be taught, and then also the scientific evidence that might challenge evolution. I think that that should also be taught.
Yeah.
And so it's very important to investigate this legal question of whether that is legal.
Yeah. And you know, Casey, I had the same experience. I remember going to college in the early 70s, and somebody came up to me and says, hey, have you ever taken a look at the scientific evidence challenging evolution? I said, what scientific evidence? Because up to that point, no one, none of my professors, no one had ever challenged my thinking on the subject. So over the years, though, I've come to appreciate the significance of that in terms of, you know, freedom of speech rights, et cetera, and I know you have as well. Is there, though, based on what you just said, is there a legal problem with teaching critiques of evolution in public schools? Because I noticed that there are groups out there who are opposed to ID in any way, shape, or form, and they don't seem to like the idea of presenting critiques of evolution very much. And even though there may not be a legal problem with teaching critiques, you know, critiquing evolution, doesn't the idea pose a risk to schools where this is actually being practiced and for educators who want to provide the scientific evidence you've been talking about here?
I think as far as the law is concerned, there is no court decision or law that would say that teaching scientific critiques of evolution in public schools is illegal. As a matter of fact, in the 1987 case from the U.S. Supreme Court, Edwards versus Aguillard, they said that in many cases it could be permissible to teach scientific critiques of prevailing scientific theories. And that case, of course, was in the context of teaching biological origins. And so I do think that the courts, even the U.S. Supreme Court, has suggested that it is permissible to do this. And you have to do it, of course, with a legitimate secular purpose to enhance and improve science education. And I think that that's what you should want to do, you know, in the first place. I mean, that should be your whole point here in teaching evolution objectively, is to improve what students learn in the science classroom. Now, you mentioned some of the groups that oppose teaching ID. Anybody who is familiar with Discovery Institute's take on this topic knows that we actually oppose mandating intelligent design in public schools. Now, we do think that ID is constitutional, but we oppose mandating it because we think that the best thing for ID is to not have it forced into the curriculum in public schools and turn into a political hot potato, but to allow it to progress as a science and have it be a scientific debate rather than a political one. But that having been said, teaching scientific critiques of evolution is definitely very different from going so far as to advocate an alternative to evolution like ID. People often confuse the two, especially our critics who sometimes purposefully conflate the two. They will conflate simply giving scientific critiques of evolution with everything from teaching ID to teaching creationism to teaching religion. I have literally seen quotes from the Darwin lobby saying that critiquing evolution is the same as pushing creationism or teaching religion in public schools. That is absolutely not true. That is absolutely false. What's going on here is that the Darwin lobby, they are using the First Amendment, which was designed to be used as a protection of freedom of speech, as really a tool for censorship. They're trying to use the Establishment Clause, which was designed to protect the separation of church and state, as a tool to censor legitimate scientific viewpoints. And in my view, that's an absolute abuse of the First Amendment when you try to censor legitimate scientific views on the false grounds that they comprise teaching religion. That is an abuse of the First Amendment.
It seems that when teachers present scientific views that are consistent with the so-called scientific consensus regarding evolution, it's called science. But whenever an educator or even scientist presents scientific views or evidence challenging the consensus view, it's often called religion.
Well, this is a little game that we play. This is a little game that they play, trying to pretend that if you're not supporting Darwinism, that it, you know, the most convenient way to censor that from students, because that's what they're really trying to do, is they're trying to censor science that challenges Darwin from the minds of students. The most convenient way for them to achieve their goal of censorship is to relabel the science that challenges, yep, Darwin as religion. And because, you know, it's a good thing that we have the Establishment Clause that prevents any religion from being adopted by the government and promoted in public schools. That's a good thing, but it's a bad thing when people take that good rule and then try to twist science that challenges Darwin into religion in order to censor it. And that is, you know, I really find that just absolutely disgusting and abhorrent, both as someone of the science and a legal background.
Yeah. You know, and as I read through these cases in your article, I was reminded again and again, because you make reference to the whole concept of advocating secular purpose whenever science education is dealt with and whenever teachers talk. So I think that if I could just mention it before I forget, that maybe a good follow-up thing for you and I maybe to do would be to identify all of the secular purposes that, and I know you've listed some in your article here, but I think it'd be good to do a treatment of what those secular purposes are and tie them directly to cases, maybe do a little expansion on what those are. I think that'd be even more helpful.
Well, my article definitely does that. It looks at the various secular purposes that have been legitimized from these cases for teaching evolution or teaching scientific critiques of evolution. So, I mean, you raise a very good point there, and we can get into this later, but I mean, some of the legitimate secular purposes have been to encourage critical thinking or to disclaim any orthodoxy of beliefs or to try to diffuse the community controversy that is caused when this controversial subject of origins is taught. That's a very good point you make, and I think that you're absolutely right. We need to help teachers understand what are the benefits to students from teaching evolution objectively.
Okay, so let's just get into the survey a little bit. Your survey groups these cases into three groups, and then you have another thing you talk about. You've got cases upholding the right to teach evolution. You've got another group of cases rejecting the teaching of alternatives to evolution, another group of cases rejecting disclaimers regarding the teaching of evolution, then a section on evolution policies that have not engendered lawsuits. So I guess as we get into each of these categories, if you just provide us with a little summary of what they are, and then maybe a little practical perspective on how you think this arrangement helps those of us who are going to use the survey. So in the first section on the cases upholding the right to teach evolution, you talk about the Epperson versus Arkansas case. What's the key essence of that case that you think is important?
Well, Epperson versus Arkansas was actually the first case regarding the teaching of evolution to reach the U.S. Supreme Court. It was handed down in 1968, so it's very long-standing legal precedent, over 40 years old now. And the basic rule of law that comes out of that case is that it is essentially illegal to prohibit and ban the teaching of evolution. And there are also some other important points we can draw from that, namely that when courts assess evolution policies, they're going to very closely scrutinize the motives of the policymakers, the educators, or the legislators to make sure that they are based upon a legitimate secular purpose. And additionally, a very important rule of law that comes out of that case that has been cited in many, many other subsequent cases is the neutrality doctrine. The neutrality doctrine is basically the concept that the government must maintain neutrality in matters of religion in public schools. They cannot attack or oppose religion, nor can they advocate or try to benefit religion. So they have to remain neutral in matters of religion.
Okay, and if I could just inject here that our listeners can go and download Casey's article at www.discovery.org/a/11291. Casey, you know, you've got a little section here on the importance of this case, and I know you've touched on this, but you say here that in your article, science and religion necessarily deal with many of the same questions, and that they may frequently provide conflicting answers. Now, this was... Who's this from? What was that quote from? It's basically the court found that there is no constitutional problems with teaching, only the pro-Darwin scientific evidence stating that it's not the business of government to suppress real or imagined attacks upon a particular religious doctrine. And yet, that's exactly what some of these cases do, isn't it?
Well, I mean, this case that you just quoted is from a district court case called Wright v. Houston, where a lower court in the federal courts found that it is legal to teach just the pro-Darwin scientific evidence. And so what the court is basically saying here is that even if religion deals with questions of origins, if you're approaching it from a scientific standpoint, then you should not be censoring that science just because religion might also talk about the same subject. And I actually agree with that. I think that we should not be censoring science because religion and science both happen to deal with the same topic. That works both ways, though, because some people do not want science taught that some religious viewpoints might find is more compatible. And it's the evolutionists who are trying to censor the science that challenges Darwinism, because you know they want to use this in a different way.
Okay, well, you know, this is fascinating, Casey, and we'll be right back after the break with our special guest Casey Luskin on Darwin or Design.
For more on the legal issues surrounding teaching the controversy, stay tuned. I'm Keith Pinnock with ID the Future, and thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.